This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
And we've got to look at the attitudinal aspect of that first mitzvah. The attitudinal aspect of that first mitzvah is I must serve God. I must be willing to serve God. That means I must do what He wants me to do. That's the essence of serving Him. Serving means I must be willing to take care of His needs. And we talk about service. What is it? A hotel that offers good service, an airline that offers good service. What does that mean? That they pour the tea well, or that they check you in quickly, or that they clean your room properly. What does it mean? It means all of that. It means a hotel that is willing to do whatever you need. That's top class service. To make sure that your needs are taken care of, your desires are taken care of, whatever you want, they will take care of. That's service. So what is service of God? We need to excel in the way we serve God. We've got to see ourselves as service agents for God, responsible for God's happiness. We've got to make sure that God is taken care of, that He's comfortable in this difficult world. This is not a world in which He would naturally feel comfortable. He doesn't like to feel restrained and restricted. He doesn't like to feel surrounded by some of the ugly things that surround us. So this isn't a place where God normally feels comfortable. We've got to make Him feel comfortable here. We've got to make Him feel good here. We are the service officers. We are the frontliners to make God feel comfortable. That's avodah. And how do you develop a service ethic in an organization? One of the very first and simple things that you do, you have to do a whole lot more than that, but one of the very simple things is no customers, no job. So you owe them one. You need them. Don't look at them as necessary evils. If you get onto an aeroplane early enough, you occasionally catch one hostess saying to the other, "Oh, here they come. You know, get ready, here they come." Because they're a nuisance. Like the best thing would be for them if the plane was empty and there were no passengers. That would be the best thing. What they don't realize is if that happens too often, no passengers, no jobs. Service requires a sense of indebtedness, a sense of I owe you. I will do anything to make you happy because I can't afford to lose you. That's a sense of service. And that's what Avodas Hashem is. That's what serving God means. It doesn't mean work for Him as a slave. It means work for Him as a service-focused person who wants to make God feel good, wants to give Him nachas, wants to make God happy. Now, why would I do that? What do I owe God? He created me. Nobody asked Him to. I didn't put the order in to be created. I was very happy up there. Who asked God to put me here? So that's not the reason. The reason is, if I wasn't serving God, where would I be today? That's what Pesach's all about. I would be still in the service business. The Jew has no choice but to be in the service business. The only choice is, do you want to serve Pharaoh or do you want to serve God? We were serving Pharaoh. God took us out. So we got a new customer. We got a new master. We got a new shareholder. However we want to see God. And you remember we talked about that many, many months ago. But that doesn't matter. We have a force. We have a being. We have an entity that we need to please. We've always had an entity that we've needed to please since we came to Egypt. The important thing is we liberated ourselves from having to please Pharaoh. But in return for that, we have to please God. And that sense of indebtedness for coming out of Egypt, that sense of thanking God for making us independent of man, that's what Egypt was about. Egypt was not just liberating us from Pharaoh. Egypt was liberating us from the need to serve humans, from the capacity to serve God instead of serving humans. Of course, part of God is serving humans. God instructs us. One of the things we need to do to make God happy is to make people happy. But we're doing that because God has told us to do that, not because we're dependent on the other human being. Our dependency is upon God. And that's the biggest liberating force. But unless we feel liberated by that, unless we feel enormously grateful that that's where we're at, then there isn't the beginning of the Ten Commandments. And one of the first character tests that anybody should put themselves through, never mind anybody else through, is the level of discomfort with indebtedness. If a person is comfortable with indebtedness, run. Run 100 miles, run 1,000 miles. Don't surround yourself with people who don't mind being indebted, because they will drain you, they will destroy you, they will walk over you, and they will feel nothing. people who feel comfortable with indebtedness, people who are not looking all the time as to what can they do to create indebtedness rather than to be indebted. Because we've discussed it before, and I'm going over it again because it's so vitally central to everything and right at the heart of the Ten Commandments. And thank you, Eric, for reminding me to address this issue. Mr. Streit says, there are people in the shul and in the shiur who tend to remind me of everything that my brother or father said about any verse I happen to quote. He says, but he's one better. He knows all my shiurim from South Africa, so he reminds me what I said on that verse so many years ago. And after last week's shiur, he said, don't forget, in such and such a year when you were speaking about this, you mentioned that, it was really great, don't let them miss out on it, you better talk about it again. So thank you, Eric. I would have missed it. There are two ways of being. The one is to be, I suppose there are three. The one is to be comfortable being indebted. The one is to be comfortable having other people indebted to you. And the third is to be comfortable with an equilibrium. If you're comfortable with an equilibrium, then you're a cultish fish, you're a cold fish, who cannot engage in any form of relationship. Because that means your most comfortable position is where you owe nothing and no one owes you. You do no kindness and no one does, and you don't accept any kindness. That's the best. So you're a thing, you're not a person. And there are things around too. The next one is the person who is comfortable with indebtedness. Doesn't mind taking. Doesn't realize that there are no free lunches. Doesn't realize that if I've taken, if I've received, I'm obligated. He doesn't feel the obligation. He just doesn't sense the obligation. And it's exactly the same as lending money. If you lend money to somebody who feels the sense of obligation and is aware of it and is conscious of it and is embarrassed by it, you're secure. The creditor doesn't mind. The creditor can handle that. And there's a much higher level of comfort from his point of view. The worst thing is when a creditor lends somebody money and the debtor acts as if it's his. Doesn't feel any kind of indebtedness at all. That's one of the disturbing things. There are a lot of very exciting things about what's happening with what they call the new economy. A lot of very exciting things and a lot of very meaningful things. But there are some things that are not so exciting and are much more disturbing. And one of them is the willingness with which young entrepreneurs are willing to take investors' money and not necessarily feel the obligation to provide returns. To provide other things, but not returns. In investing, when you invest in a company, when you invest in a child, when you invest in a friend, when you invest in a spouse, what are you investing in? The more the recipient of the investment feels uncomfortable with receiving, the greater will be the returns. To invest in somebody or something who feels comfortable with receiving, the lower will be the returns. There will be no sense of need to create return. And then you've got the person who's uncomfortable with receiving. What does the person who's uncomfortable with receiving do? He doesn't refuse to receive, because that wouldn't create relationship. He receives, but he reciprocates. And he reciprocates far more than he receives. And he reciprocates quickly. And he reciprocates generously. And he creates the indebtedness in the other person so that not only is the imbalance not against his favor, but that the imbalance is quickly turned around in his favor. And in some areas that's understood. In our society, it's understood in the area of political favors. Politicians like doing favors, but they only like doing favors to people who have the capacity to do favors back. They do not like doing favors for people who do not have the capacity to do favors back. And that infiltrates into our whole society. It's not just politicians. Generally, people like doing favors for people who can do favors back. They don't mind investing in somebody who will reciprocate. And there's an unwritten law in the political world that if you ask for a favor, you'd better be ready for payout time when it comes. You can't refuse to do the favor back when it comes. That's, you trade in favors. And business operates the same way. It works in many areas. One of the areas in which we are most flawed in our society is in the social area. Somehow you'll have people who understand it in business, that you invest and you expect a return, and you receive and you want to give back. They understand it clearly in business. They understand it in politics. They do a favor for their senator, because they know they're going to ask for a favor from the senator. That's the reason they do it, and they know that that's exactly how it operates. And when the senator comes to them and asks them for money for their party or for their campaign, they write that check with joy and pleasure because they know there will be payback. So they understand that principle. And in social life, it doesn't exist. Social life becomes take, 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 take. How much can I take from the people around me? There isn't the same kind of understanding that social life operates with exactly the same rules and principles. They are moral rules. They are Torah principles. They are God's principles. The principle of discomfort with indebtedness. Create indebtedness in the other person. Make people indebted to you because that gives you the most power. The more people are indebted to you, the more powerful you are. Not the other way around. And that's the first of the Ten Commandments, says God. You're indebted to me. Don't you want to return? Don't you want to tip the scales a little bit? Don't you want to feel uncomfortable with that? If you do, remember I took you out of Egypt and you owe me something. You owe it to me to make me happy. You owe it to me to do my will. And here is my will. The other nine commandments are my will. And the first thing that God says is verse 3. So that's on page 408. Lo yiyeh lecho Elohim achirim al panai. You shall not have any other gods before me. Now, interestingly, in some chumashim, this sentence is part of the first commandment. In my chumash, for example, that's all one sentence. I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt from the land of bondage. You shall have no other god before me. There comes the period, not beforehand. The second commandment starts with the next sentence. Lo ta'aseh lecho pesel, you shall create no graven image, no idols or graven images. So it's not clear that there are two views as to whether the first commandment ends with I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, or the consequence of that, and therefore there shall be no other gods before me, is still part of that first commandment. But whichever way we learn it, clearly the first two commandments are very interlinked and are two sides of the same coin. I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. I am the only one who took you out of Egypt, and I am therefore the only God that you have, and there shall therefore be no other gods before me. And that introduces us to the concept of idolatry. There are very few idol worshippers who don't believe in God. So to think that idolatry is the same as atheism, that's not how it is at all. Idolaters generally do believe in God. The Rambam makes it very clear. He traces the history of idolatry. And he says in the beginning of Hilchos Avodas Kechavim, I'll do some of it with you inside. Bimei Enosh, in the days of Enosh, that was before, long before the time of Avraham. Ta'u b'nei ha'odom to'us godol. Humankind made an enormous mistake, an intellectual error. V'nivoro atzas chachmei oso ador v'enosh atzmo min ha'toyim haya. And Enosh himself was one of those mistaken people. V'zu ho'oso ta'usom, and this was their error. Omru, they held, they said, Ho'il v'ha'elokim berokei chovim eilu v'gagalim lahanigis ha'ilam. God clearly created these stars and constellations and astrological forces that impact on the earth. V'nesonom b'morom, and he put them up in the heavens. V'chilek lahem kovod, and he gave them a lot of glory. There he put them, we look at them, we gaze at them in the heavens in wonder and astonishment. God gave them a position of enormous superiority. V'hem shamoshim ha-meshamshim lefonov. And they are the servants of God. They do God's will. Notice how God-centered it is still. Re'uyim heim l'shamchom l'farim v'lachloyim kovod. Surely God wants us to honor them if they are God's servants and doing His will. V'zeu ratzon ha-kel baruch hu. This must be God's will. L'gadol l'chabed mishe gadlo v'chabdo. To honor and ingratiate ourselves to He who God honors. Just as a king wants you to honor his ministers, the king, the fact that you're honoring the minister doesn't mean you're denying the king. On the contrary, you're honoring the king by honoring the ministers. So they viewed the astrological forces of the world as the ministers of God, and they honored those forces as a way of honoring God. Once they got this in their heads, they started building temples to the stars. ulakriv lahem korbonos, and to bring sacrifices, ulashabchom, ulafarim, bidvorim, and to praise them with poetry and words, ulishtachavos lemulam, to bow down to them, kedela hasig ritzon habere bedatam haro, so as to do God's will according to their mistaken thoughts. Vazeh haro ikar avodas kechavim, and that was the root of avodas kechavim, of idolatry. So idolatry was not a denial of God. Idolatry was an expansion of God. But when you expand the truth, you're dealing with falsehood. But just as the truth cannot be contracted, so the truth cannot be expanded. And idolatry is when we try and expand the truth to include too much. The truth is big, it's broad, and we have to understand its bigness. But the moment we try and make it all-inclusive, we lose it. And so you'll hear people saying today, as many times, well, you know, don't know if Orthodox is good, Conservative is good, Reform is good, it's all one religion. It's all, it isn't all one religion, and it isn't all okay. They say three opposite things. They can't all be right. Now, we would like them all to be right, because that avoids conflict, and we don't like conflict. We don't have to choose. We can be friends with everybody. But that's idolatry. To expand the truth, to embrace falsehood, is one of the biggest tricks of illusion, and it creates an enormous sense of comfort, because you know what, if they're all right, then I can't be wrong. It's very comfortable to say everybody's right. It's very comfortable to make truth so broad that it encompasses every falsehood as well, because that imposes no obligation on me. And here we come to the essential motivating force of idolatry. Idolatry is the desire to kind of de-godlify, there's such a word, God. So when you hear somebody saying, you know, I don't call him God, I call it the universe. There, of course there's a force, and there's a creative force, and then all the rest of it. I call it the universe, or I call it nature, or I call it the Holy One, or I call it the Eternal One, or whatever it is. The moment you give it another name, what you're doing is you're saying, there is a force, but it doesn't govern me. It doesn't place moral obligation on me. It governs me in terms of affecting me. Sure, it controls me. It manipulates me. So I am a victim of that force. But it doesn't judge me. Because we don't like to be judged. And so much do we not like to be judged that we're even willing to stop judging others so that we shouldn't be judged either. And there is a kind of a tacit social agreement among us. Don't tell me what to do and I won't tell you what to do. Don't judge me and I won't judge you. Because we feel uncomfortable with the very concept of judgment, because judgment implies right and wrong, true and false. It implies a responsibility to that which is true. And don't think that idolatry means I don't believe in God. Idolatry simply means God doesn't believe in me. That's when it becomes idolatry. That I am not important enough for God to be watching, monitoring, rewarding, judging, rewarding and punishing. When I think God is distant, or I am distant from God, and that I'm not important enough for that, or that the world is not important enough for that, that's when I'm onto idolatry. When I start calling God the universe, when I start calling God nature, when I start calling God things that are neutral, that don't have any kind of moral force to them, that's when I'm starting to say I'm serving nature as God's instrument. Because clearly nature doesn't judge me. The sun and the moon don't judge me. They influence me, but they don't judge me. And so I'm more comfortable with astrology than I am with God. Astrology impacts on me, it doesn't judge me. And the moment I see God as a force rather than a judge, I've missed it and I'm onto the idolatry stuff. Idolatry doesn't mean I'm not spiritual. Idolatry means I am spiritual. People who are not spiritual are not idol worshippers. They're not even there. Being an idol worshipper is a religious level. One is a religious person when one is an idol worshipper. One is not an irreligious person. One is an extremely religious person by being an idol worshipper. The Tales of Rob used to say, we think that idolatry was a primitive thing, and that we have evolved beyond idolatry. He says, that's absurd. Idolatry was a very sophisticated level of religious belief. We have no concept of it. We are so secular that we're not even idol worshippers. Even that we're not willing to accept. We don't worship anything. But idol worship was a level of spiritual and religious sophistication. It was just untrue. But it was spiritual. So we kind of think that the world is divided up into believers in God and the others. That's true. The believers in God and the others. Although I don't know many people who don't believe in God in one form or another. So I would rather not divide the world into those who believe in God and those who don't. I believe that most people, or nearly all people, believe in God in one form or another. That's not what differentiates us. What differentiates us is those who believe in God and those who believe in idols. And there are very, very few people who believe in God. Most of us believe in idols. And I'll show that to you. I'll demonstrate that to you. Chodas Halvovas to you, the duties of the heart. So here's a section called Sha'ar Yichud HaMaaseh, the chapters that deal with Yichud HaMaaseh. Yichud HaMaaseh means doing unimotivation, single-minded motivation of deeds, of actions. And I'm going to do two sections with you. First one, he says, in the previous chapter, says the Chovas HaRovas, I dealt with the need to trust in God, to believe in God. It is now reasonable that I should deal with the next issue, which is the obligation upon us to do all the activities of service of God out of an intent to serve God alone, only God. That single-mindedness saves us from tzvi'ut. Tzvi'ut is, hypocrisy is probably one of the nearest words. Is there any another word of that type? Just serving two different interests, being one thing to one person and another thing to another person. Do you know that? Is hypocrisy the right word? Can you think of a better one? Jad, anything better than that? Tzviut. Tzviut means being too colorful, having too many colors, being a chameleon, is what it means. And he then goes on to say that a very astonishing statement. This is now Rabbeinu Bechaya, this is not me. Ve'yesh yitaron lo'eved kechovim al hachoynef ba'arba dvorim. An idol worshipper is on a higher level than a flatterer in four ways. Don't think, I don't serve idols. I flatter occasionally, but I don't serve idols. Says Rabbeinu Bechaya, rather serve idols. Less dangerous. Idolatry is less dangerous and less damaging than flattery. Do you know anybody who doesn't flatter? And he gives the four reasons. First one, he says, because if you're worshipping idols, we're not living in the times of prophets where the prophets point out what is an idol and what isn't, and they keep on warning us. So you can claim a kind of I didn't really realize that this was idolatry. But if you say the Shema, and in the Shema you say, I believe that there's only one God, that means there's only one force capable of impacting on my life. And why would I flatter? So by saying the Shema every day, one is undertaking not to flatter anybody. And when one flatters, one is undermining the integrity of the Shema. Okay, so that's one point. The second one is, an idol worshipper doesn't serve someone who disobeys God. Say the sun, the moon, different forces, astrology. You serve God's servants. But the person who serves God like a chameleon, who changes his colors, he serves both people who serve God, and he serves wicked people too. He'll serve anybody. Doesn't he? He's indiscriminate in who he serves. At least the idol worshipper chooses his idols. The flatterer doesn't. The flatterer will serve anybody who can do him a favor. Third reason, an idol worshipper generally serves one idol, whereas this individual serves infinite numbers of idols. And the fourth one, perhaps the most important one of all, the idol worshipper is easy to identify, and so people can keep their distance from him. But the flatterer looks like a religious person, and people think he's a religious person. They don't realize he's worse than an idol worshipper. They don't realize who he is and what he is. And so they are taken in by his charm, and they are ingratiated by him, and they form bonds with him, not realizing that they're dealing with somebody is worse than an idol worship. This is the kind of confrontational, challenging material that the Chovas HaRovas is filled with. Words that force us to question ourselves and to challenge ourselves. And isn't that what the Torah should be? We've often talked about the fact that we enjoy entertainment. And we enjoy entertainment because life is hard. So when we've got a little bit of spare time, we like to be entertained. But that's not what the Torah is. The Torah is not about entertainment. And sometimes in our effort to sell Judaism and the Torah in the biggest packages possible, we incorporate entertainment in it, and we sort of say, here's the whole thing, we'll provide you with kosher entertainment and kosher this and kosher that, and we wrap it all together. In a way, it would be better to go and get our entertainment somewhere else, at places that are really good at entertainment. And when we come to Torah, to be challenging ourselves, to be questioning ourselves, to be stretching ourselves, to feel the discomfort that challenge forces, to feel the discomfort that precedes change and growth. That's what Torah is. Idolatry is exactly the opposite. Idolatry is a religion that doesn't challenge, because everybody wants a religion. There are very few people who feel comfortable without a religion, especially when things get a little bit tough. When the bullets are going, when there's an accident, when there's illness, the biggest atheists find a religion very quickly. It's not that difficult to believe when things are difficult, and it's not that difficult to believe in something all the time. Most people want a religion. They want some form of spirituality. But they want a religion that cradles them. They want a religion that offers them security. That's why they want the religion. And religion does offer one a security. The only security religion should offer, the Torah should offer, is the security that you'll never stop questioning yourself. The security that you'll never stay the same. The security that you'll never get into a habit. The security that you will always grow and stretch. The security that when you're an old person, you won't be as immature as you were when you were a young person. Those are the securities it should offer. It doesn't offer the other securities that we tend to cling to it for. How often do you hear people saying or thinking, keep kosher, and it's a healthy thing to do, it can't be a bad thing. Keep Shabbos, keeps families together. Keep the laws of family purity, it keeps families together. It doesn't. It doesn't. It helps. But it doesn't guarantee. And there are other things that help too, that are as valuable from that perspective. But what a proper Shabbos does do, and what all the laws that we keep, and the study of Torah, keneged kulam, as the Mishnah says, the most important of all of them is the study of Torah, because without the study of Torah, they become habits. Without the study of Torah, the whole of religion becomes a ritual. It's only the study of Torah that infuses some kind of sense of challenge in the keeping of the mitzvahs. If you keep the mitzvahs without the study of Torah, you're getting into a new routine, that's all. And is there a security in a routine? Yes, there's security in a Buddhist routine, there's security in a Catholic routine, there's security in a Jewish routine. There's nothing unique about our routine. Take any religion you want, and you'll find that security. Ours is a little bit more rigorous and a bit more routine, but it's the same kind of thing. That's not our selling point, that's not what we offer. What we offer, if it comes with learning, is constant challenging. A piece of Chovas HaRovas like this, that's the gems of the Torah. A piece of Chovas HaRovas that takes the second commandment, and we read through it flippantly and think, yeah, second commandment, that doesn't apply to us. On to the third one, and the Chovas HaRovas says, stop right there! It's talking to you! You see that idol worship it's talking about? The man that God despises? That idolatry that God wants uprooted from the world and utterly and totally destroyed? Go through Masechta Avodah Zorah, go through the tractate on idolatry, go through the sections in the Rambam, go through the sections throughout the Gemara that talk about it, go through Tanakh, see how God hates it. And then read this one paragraph that we learned today, and realize that as much as God hates that, He hates flattery more. Now read the second commandment again, and understand what it means. The second commandment means believing that anybody but God can impact on us. God and ourselves. Our choices and God. That's what impacts. Yes, we have discussed that other people through their free choice can also impact on us. Somebody can take out a gun and shoot us. Somebody can drive into us. And God has a hand in that. It's not as if God doesn't have a hand in that. But in terms of our spiritual well-being, where we are and where we're going to be long term, and our capacity to earn and our state of health, all the things that really matter, there are only two forces that need to be taken account of: me and God, my choices and God's responses. There isn't another force. There just isn't. And that's very hard to believe when nature looks different, when life looks different. And the second commandment is, don't look at the illusion, look at the truth. You're living in a world of illusion. You're living in a world where there appears to be a causality that isn't a true one. If you analyze and you think and you challenge and you question, you will find the only true causality are your choices and my response, says God. And that's the second commandment. And when you start flattering, what you're saying is, there is value in that person. He can do something for me that God can't. And if we put, let me take a step back on that, that does not mean that we don't make effort. That does not mean that we don't have to go out there and search and look and do. We have to. God instructs us. God says, no miracles. I'm the only one, and it's my response to you that makes things happen. So you have to go out and do the things that naturally appear to be where there appears to be natural causality. And there are even cases where halakhically you have to flatter. But you'd better know what you're doing. Know the law that you're keeping. Know why you're flattering. And know that it's not the flattery that's going to bring the result. In this case, God requires you to flatter, so you flatter. Just as God requires you to put in a tefillin in the morning, God requires you to light your Friday night candle. There are times when God requires you to go out and do certain things, otherwise He won't respond. But we need to know where the response comes from and under what conditions we can flatter and what conditions we cannot, and never to take the flattering seriously. Never to believe that we're flattering because that person holds the key to our future. That person holds the key to anything beyond the ability of God. And of course, the big test of flattery is how much we place on the flattery and how much we place on prayer. So if one's going to a business occasion, and one believes that there's an opportunity to do particularly well, if one's able to build a particular relationship, and that's going to require flattery. Even let us say it's flattery which is allowed, that's still okay. But the big test will be is, what was your davening like this morning? If you rush through your davening to get to business so that you can get to your social occasion and do your flattering, what are you saying? Davening, yes, because that's just one of the things you do, so let's get it done. Oiling the wheels of business this evening, that's where it all happens. That's idolatry. That's believing that there's a force in the world other than God. To spend an extra 10 minutes on davening and to say two chapters of Tehillim afterwards because there's an important business occasion, and then to go and do what you have to do, and to come back and wash your hands after you've done it. Wash your hands with soap first and then with a cup, you know, just get it really clean before you daven Maariv again. Then you're okay. That's not idolatry. That's dirtying your hands with the realities of life, but not dirtying your mind or heart. And that's a big difference. That's how a person stays pure. And it's so hard to stay pure when the forces around us are pushing us in different directions altogether. More time on idolatry. Next week we'll spend some time on idolatry too. We're not finished with it yet. I don't mean we'll spend time serving idolatry, I mean we'll spend time studying idolatry. I guess between now and next week we'll spend lots of time serving idolatry. That's just the way life is. But there's some interesting comments that we find. For example, in the Medrash Tanchuma. Just to give you a sense, and we'll continue some of this next week. What happens if there's a candle burning that has an idolatrous image on it? Can you take a light from it? Now, we're not allowed to benefit from idolatry, but the Medrash is questioning whether to take a light from it. That light still burns. You haven't taken that light. You've merely lit your candle from that candle. Is that a problem? Answers the Medrash, Kach Shonu Rabbeinu. This is what our rabbis have taught. If there is a candle with a design of idolatry on it, a Jew may not light from it. Why not? Because the Shekhinah, God's presence, doesn't rest where there's any attachment to idolatry. And the proof is that as long as Avraham had Lot with him, God's presence didn't rest on Avraham. Only after Lot separated from Avraham did God come to Avraham. So our capacity to attract divine force results not only from our ability to access God, but also from the other things we're accessing at the same time. If we got accessing God plus others, God keeps away. The only time God will allow himself to be present with us is when we exclude other forces. We see them only as part of God and as instruments of God, but not as capable of impacting on us. When we've been able to exclude, and that's why the second commandment is limiting. The first commandment is embracing. I am the Lord your God. I am everything. The second commandment, and if I am everything, then there is nothing but me. And if you admit anything but me, I pull out. That's the condition. So the Medrash then queries, if you smell a beautiful scent of idolatry, do you make a bracha? Do you say Bereimene Besomim? What do? Kachshonu Rabbeinu, this is what our rabbis taught. Ein mevorchin al haner, v'lo al besomim, v'lo al reach shel avedus kechavim. You do not bless a candle, incense, or spices of idolatry. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael, God said to the Jewish people, Al tit'u achar avedus kechavim she'ein bo mamash. Don't err after idolatry because it's illusionary, it's not real. That's the objection. And when you start smelling something and making a bracha, you would think, you know, if you smelled something nice, why not make a bracha? What can be wrong? So it's an idolatry smell, but it's a beautiful smell, so you make a bracha. I don't want that bracha, because the moment you start attaching anything of God to that, you start giving it credibility. You start turning it into something real in your mind. Rather see it for what it is. Because when you smell something and you say a brocha, the brocha enhances the smell. Because you're tracking the source of it, you're finding meaning in it, you're finding spirituality in the smell. Just as a brocha should enhance taste, a brocha should enhance a smell. And to enhance the smell, even though it's just an aroma, you're not taking anything from it, you're not benefiting from it, other than enjoying the aroma. And you're going to enjoy that in any case. You're walking past and it smells beautiful. Says God, that's fine, just now don't mention my name there. Don't give it the credibility of a bracha, because that starts in your mind subconsciously attaching some kind of importance to something which has no importance, to something which is completely a non-event. It has no function and it has no purpose. And we'll discuss that in greater detail next week, the extent to which idolatry is the illusion of something real. When we try to give credibility to something that doesn't deserve credibility, and we like giving credibility to everything, because if we give credibility to everything, we don't have to deal with conflict, we don't have to call anybody, we don't have to put our foot down with anything, we don't have to draw the line anywhere, and we feel comfortable with not having to do that. But I spoke in Shul on Shabbos about how much we're willing to sow for efficiency. What are we willing to put on the sacrifice, on the altar of efficiency? And we went through all the things that we're willing to sacrifice for efficiency. And the last thing left which we're about to sacrifice on the altar of efficiency is our own dignity. Just about there, where even that, if it's more efficient, okay, it's all right. Okay. And our willingness to sacrifice almost anything to avoid conflict, to avoid saying no, to avoid taking a stand and making a sacrifice, is what leads us into the realm of idolatry, of giving credence, giving credibility to something which isn't real, just because we're not willing to say, the emperor has no clothes. Everybody thinks he has clothes, but he doesn't. And I'll show you that he doesn't. We prefer to live with the illusion that he does, because that way we can get on with everybody and we can carry on doing business and having parties and everything's fine. So let's say he's got clothes. Who cares whether he has or he hasn't? Who cares? It's just not true. That's what's wrong. And we will accept untruth if everybody else does. But that's not the Torah. That's where the Torah challenges us. Even if everybody accepts it, we've got to question it. And we can't just go along with it. Even the norms that society finds acceptable, we have to challenge and we have to question if there's illusion involved, if there's something that isn't true and something that isn't real. That doesn't mean we don't have to have fun with illusion, or we may not have fun with illusion. Have fun with illusion. Just don't take it seriously. Have fun with the illusion. But know it's only a story. Know it's not real. And then one can start functioning. And the capacity to differentiate that which is real from that which is illusion is the move from the first commandment to the second. I am the Lord your God. I am real. I am true. Whatever is real and true links into me. But that means that whatever isn't real and true is foreign to me and should be foreign to you too. Thank you.